Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to EMForum.org. I'm Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today. We are very glad you could join us. For our newcomers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. Now, you may recall that during February, we featured the FEMA listening sessions on, quote, strengthening community engagement in preparedness and resilience efforts. Today, we will focus specifically on private sector engagement, so crucial to this effort. A recent study report titled Building Disaster Resilience Through Private-Public Collaboration was linked from our announcement and is also linked from our homepage. Please note that the PDF version of the report is available from the National Academies Press at no cost. In addition, there is a brief summary of the highlights of the report that you can access and download right now by clicking on the icon of the three overlapping note pages, and that's just a nice four-page summary. And there are a number of other related links on today's background page. Now, for the benefit of our first-timers, we will begin with a presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. Now, if you have any difficulty with live meeting, you may use the feedback drop-down menu up here at the top right, and then my associates, Ava Jean Moore and Lori Weaver, will monitor that and try to assist you. And if they are able to help you, please then do change your color back to green. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. And we also ask you not to send any private messages to the speakers or moderator, as you can imagine, we will be busy. We are making a recording, and that should be available later this afternoon, and then there will be a text transcript posted early next week. Now, if you're not on our mailing list, you can go to our homepage and subscribe, and then you will get a notice when the materials are posted. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. Dr. William Hook chaired the study committee and also serves as Senior Policy Fellow and Director for the American Meteorological Society. Bill had a long tenure with NOAA, and between 1993 and 2000, he held two national responsibilities, Director of the U.S. Weather Research Program Office and Chair of the Interagency Subcommittee for Natural Disaster Reduction. We're also pleased to introduce the study director, Samantha Magsino, Program Officer for the National Research Council's Board on Earth Sciences and Resources. Before coming to the National Research Council, she was a geologist with the Washington State Geologic Survey. Samantha will help us out during the Q&A portion of our program. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to Bill to start us off, please.
All right, well, thank you very much, Amy, and thank you, Abhijean, and I'm very grateful to the EMForum.org for providing this opportunity. It's wonderful to be able to talk about this report, and especially so for the following two reasons, which are not really captured in the slide, but which I want to mention as we get started here. The first is that I think there's a tendency, not on the part of any of the folks on this phone call, but most folks worldwide, to think of disaster resilience as kind of a small sidelight to human affairs. And as I know we know through events like the Sendai earthquake or Hurricane Katrina or many of the other, the Haitian earthquake, any others, these events are not just interruptions of the natural order of things, but they're really the way that the Earth system does its business. So this idea of disaster resilience is fundamental to the human prospect. The second point is sort of the same idea with respect to private-public collaboration. I think there's a widespread view that somehow this is a public sector responsibility, the whole issues of mitigation and preparedness and response and all the rest of it. But in fact, the private-public collaboration that this report addressed is fundamental to any hopes that communities might have for building disaster resilience. And so, on the one hand, if you think of this as just another report, it's easy for those of us who are involved with it to think, gee, this was terrific. If you think about it in those terms, though, the fundamental importance of disaster resilience to human fortunes and the role of the private sector, public sector collaboration as being vital, there's still so much to be done, and we'll kind of go through some of that today. This particular report, as is true of all Academy reports, is reports, but most of them, is sponsored by an outside group. In this case, the funding came from the Department of Homeland Security and the Behavioral Sciences Division, Michael Dunaway, and we're very grateful to DHS for having the vision and insight to provide this report. So now let's see. If I go to the second slide, we'll get to look at the statement of task. And this is something that's arrived at jointly between the Academy and its National Research Council and the sponsoring groups, in this case DHS. So you see the task is to assess the current state of art in private-public collaboration to strengthen community resilience, to identify gaps in our knowledge of how that collaboration works and in the practice of it, to recommend research areas for investment. And in particular, there are sort of three pieces of this. One is we were asked to look and see if there exists a kind of common framework or a template for how such collaboration occurs. Secondly, to identify or develop guidelines that might govern how private sector and public sector groups in a community would work together to implement such a framework in their community. And finally, look at models of existing collaborations, as we might find them. And I want to highlight that third piece, because, again, I'd say this is an area where we could do a lot more work. I think if you went into any community in America, any community worldwide, you would find some private-public collaboration going on. And it would vary a great deal in how organized it was, how visible it was within the community, how sustainable it was, and so on. But there's a lot going on out there, and I think all of us feel like we could have done much more to sort of look at that. We had an outstanding committee. You see the list of names on the next slide, and as when I got approached by the Academy to be involved with this, I looked at the group and I thought, wow, this is a terrific group to be part of it. And I should highlight Sam's role. You heard Amy mention Sam Magzino at the beginning, and for those of you who might not be familiar with Academy reports, the staff directors play an absolutely crucial role in the success and effectiveness of these reports. They are essentially providing adult supervision to make sure that a bunch of happy-go-lucky scientists and people, private sector contractors, such as we had in our group and so on, who have a day job and so on, keep to task, keep to schedule, keep focused on the problem at hand. It's a job that requires a lot of intellectual capability and also zero ego, because there's enough ego on the part of the committee members to go around. So with that in mind, let's see if I can go on to the next slide. A starting point here was to think a little bit about what resilience is. And we could have spent the entire couple of years debating this. There's a lot of definitions out there. We kept trying to simplify it, make it very general. We based it on a definition provided by Norris and others that I think was a little focused on public health, but you see it's quite general. It's the continued ability of individuals, groups, or systems to function during or after stress, such as a disaster. And so getting right to it, here is the diagram that shows the major elements of the collaboration. As we saw it, this is our framework diagram that we promised, and we're going to go through the components of it now. So bear with me a little bit. We're going to first discuss the community factors and then zero in on the other pieces. So first of all, the community factors, and let's see if I can, there it is. These are the external factors that have to be taken into account. We said that in most communities, disasters and disaster resilience are sort of put aside in day-to-day affairs. It's all about the local economy and the schools and the healthcare and all the rest of that. So there's a set of external factors that must be taken into account. What sort of jurisdictions does this community operate under? What's the political climate? Levels of trust, economic levels, liability concerns, and so on. Next, the participants. And here, it's really important. We came back to this again and again to engage the full fabric of the community. There's a tendency to think of this in terms of the local government actors and maybe a few of the major industrial employers in a given city. Maybe think in terms of a few NGOs, but we found that it was important to bring in all the community organizations and all segments of the population, including the disenfranchised. As one of our committee members kept putting it, you know, the disenfranchised aren't surprised by disasters. They're living in a sort of chaotic situation day in and day out, and they have a lot of wisdom to offer, and they are the target of much of the work here. The
you skipped one, Bill.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Let's see. Implementation principles and strategies. Here are, apart from this basic guideline of bringing in all of the full fabric of the community, it's very important to understand at the outset what the goals and incentives are, to be able to have different actors intervene at multiple levels. So there's kind of a neighborhood level, there's a community level within a given community. There are also, the communities are operating within a state framework and a national framework. We found it most successful when these efforts were devoted towards building capacity, changing communities' policies and practice and environment, as opposed to being more specific. Very important to realize that disaster resilience itself is part of a larger community resilience as a whole. Resilience is not something that you can exercise once every 2 or 3 years any more than you could decide, and Sam is a long-distance runner, any more than you could decide to run a marathon today and then think maybe 18 months from now you'd run another one and not do any running in between. So the community resilience is a way of exercising this framework as you're going along and keeping it functioning well. And finally, it's very important to institutionalize these arrangements. Leaders are important. Charismatic individuals who have fire in the belly for doing this are vital. But in order to ensure that such collaborations endure beyond these folks, it's necessary to institutionalize the collaboration. Now, with regard to how things work, the emphasis is on that word collaborative management structure. It's not top-down command and control. It's not the city or the county or a region acting, regional government acting as the principal and then the private sector companies being agents or essentially subcontractors carrying out the work. It's very important that this be a level playing field. It's important to build networks to support this collaboration horizontally and vertically. It's vital to have some kind of facilitating body whose main goal is to see that this collaboration functions. And we had a lot of discussion about this, and people generally agreed that facilitating body needs to be someplace outside the government structure. It needs to be focused on the community, and it needs to build on existing networks rather than try to go around. Okay, now the final outcome, the proof of this pudding is something you see when the disaster occurs and you realize, yes, we built up a little resilience, but there are intermediate sort of steps where you and I can see whether or not we're making progress. Do we see that that collaborative management structure is in place? Do we see that the trust level among all the participants is building? Has there been a good identification of community needs and also community resources that are going to be available? Does it look that as if this collaboration is making it possible to leverage and coordinate the use of these resources more effectively? And do we see planning that's all hazards and looking at the full disaster cycle underway. This is not a do it once and you're done kind of thing. The community is constantly evolving. The circumstances surrounding the community is constantly evolving. And what's needed, it's very important to have in place a constant ability to reevaluate and sort of see how things are progressing. Now, some of the research challenges. Let's sort of focus on this a little bit. Resilience as a theory needs to be testable, needs to have some predictive power. That sort of shows you that your science and your understanding are on the right track. We've got to have some idea of what success looks like. That's got to be definable, achievable, repeatable. We ought to have metrics. It ought to be something that measurable. That turns out to be easier for me to talk about just now than it is to do in practice. So one area of research that looks pretty important to us is the ability to identify and remove barriers that prevent changes in organizational culture. Most of what we've been talking about is not something that's business as usual for communities. And so there's a real need for research that sort of evaluates as you're going along. Think of this as embedded research in the same way you have embedded reporters in a war zone. How are you doing in terms of building the trust among the collaborators? How are you doing in terms of rewarding individuals and organizations that span boundaries? Usually those rewards are few and far between. And what can we see in the way of movement towards cultures of collaboration? A key piece of this are data over extended periods of time. The longitudinal word there is kind of and I'm not a social scientist, so this is not a natural word for me, but this is the word they use for what I would describe as a long-term data set that sort of documents the community change, that validates methodologies, that provides comparable data sets for risk and resilience. Data sets that would be comparable sort of over a period of years, but also hazard to hazard or community to community, and shows some evidence for the long-term investments and evidence of the effectiveness of those investments. There's very little such data most places, and the community, the hazards community, research community sees this as a key barrier towards taking research on hazards to a new level in terms of what it can do in terms of improving practice of building disaster resilience at ground level. There's also research needed in how to motivate the players, particularly the business side. they have one major responsibility, which is to make a profit, and all of the rest of this subtracts from that profit margin in a sense. So there's a sort of constant dialogue that's needed about how this contributes to profit margins over longer terms, how this will build the brand of a corporation within a community and nationally and so on. The same thing sort of applies to community and faith-based NGOs. And, again, there are some research needed on how to motivate and how – What's there in the way of incentive and encouragement to take emergency managers and folks in Homeland Security who have a very full plate as it is to add another set of sort of requirements and issues and meetings and all the follow-up needed in a setting that provides much less control than sometimes seems like is needed for this? And then finally, there needs to be research on the whole bootstrapping part of the process. How do we, as we go along in very constrained budgets at local, state, and federal levels these days, build capacity for collaboration? We thought, again, we found ourselves favoring very much the idea of demonstration projects where researchers and on-the-ground practitioners would be able to work side by side and discuss on a very frequent, ongoing kind of basis how things were going, where practitioners would be able to explain why it is that they were taking certain actions and moving in certain ways, and researchers would be able to ask questions directly of the practitioners rather than try to guess. We also thought there should be a lot of effort devoted to how to improve nationwide sharing of such results and progress, comparison from community to community, giving us all a chance to see, hey, it's working over here in community A, and so let's all see what they're doing that we might be able to apply in our community and so on. And we saw as one means towards this that there might be some reward associated with establishing a national repository and clearinghouse for dealing with this. I want to be sure I didn't skip a slide here. So I think this is correct. So then there's the question of moving from some nice sort of theoretical ideas to practice, and we thought there were some things that could be done that would create a climate that would be, that would foster this kind of community-based collaboration. Large part of that is at a sort of national level, indicating, sending a strong signal in all sorts of ways that such collaborations are favored. So providing a strategic framework at the national level, then working on the social and political environments that recognize the need for that, exercising these networks. We've seen time and again in natural hazard work and in work in willful acts of violence and so on that the breakdown in communication that occurs in some of these horizontal networks and the vertical networks are a real challenge for everyone. And finally, what we need are techniques that are viral, that are catalytic, that are emergent, that kind of incubate the kind of mobilization that we're talking about. Again, we talked earlier about the importance of local leadership, of recognizing what the existing networks are there for, and trying, instead of putting in competing networks that are distractions and also marginally supported, that it's good to look at what's there already and think about ways to make it more robust and sort of build this in. And again, the idea that there would be somebody or some group of people who are in each community sort of helping that facilitate this whole discussion and the coordination from a neutral position. So we stress that. Okay, then it's important, again, as we talked about, to institutionalize this collaboration. And we talked about the importance of identifying community resources and capabilities that will show the immediate value of such collaboration, that will build community awareness. Very important to build community awareness of capabilities and gaps. What tools do they have available? What tools do they need? This trust thing, particularly in private sector companies looking at each other and private sector folks looking at the public sector and vice versa, we've got an awful lot of we, they in our society, and we need a lot more kind of us. Let's see. I think I just did this one. This, again, as I said, is easier to say than to do, but it's important to develop measurable objectives for, and this means not things that are easy to measure, like, oh, last week or last year we had so many private sector partners at this table, and this year we have so many, but much more on looking for measures, signs that the community is really more resilient or more coordinated than it used to be. Public education is a key piece of this, K through 12 education and public education for adults. And here is where communities, private and public sector, should reach out to local academic institutions for engagement in some of these areas. And then, again, it's imperative that communities have a good understanding of what such efforts are costing them and how they're going to sustain these costs over a period of time. So they've got an exercise that they can keep up. The last slide sort of reminds you what Amy was saying at the beginning, that it's possible to view this report online at the National Academies Press. We had an information gathering workshop that was very important to our two-year study early on. There's a web address there for reaching that and so on. So I think with that background, I think that took about 25 minutes or so. Amy, let me turn it back to you, and we'll try to have a bit of discussion going.
Thank you very much, Bill. And I will mention again that both of the links that you have here on this slide are incorporated into today's background page, and people can just hit them right from there. Okay, we will move on to our Q&A discussion. Now, to submit a question or comment, you just click on Q&A from the top menu. Then you'll type in the top half of the small window that opens up. Then you click on Ask or just hit the Enter key. Now, there is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you click on Ask, the text does not go immediately to the window. Instead, it does go to an administration panel, and then I monitor that and will announce who the question is from, read it aloud, and then our guests will respond via the conference bridge.
So we're all realizing that we should have treated Amy real well here.
Then once I've read it, I'll type in a little text, okay, and that will release the text of the question to your Q&A panel. We do ask you to keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And I'm sure Bill and Sam would also be interested in hearing about any experiences you have had related to private-public collaboration. We are ready to begin now, and you may enter your question or comment at any time. And we have a few already. Okay, we have a question, a long one. I think she put it in before I gave the instruction. This is Susan Sanderson. She says, our tax dollars are already funding volunteer organizations in disasters, Citizen Corps, However, some of our citizen core organizations include more first responders and government people because this function reports to emergency management. Some government employees just don't get it. They won't even give a council seat to businesses, nonprofits, or NGOs. They talk collaboration and have a few token large corporations. But what about medium to small business? Now we're getting to the nugget of the question here. As an emergency manager, I can tell you for our area, it's more of a problem for emergency management and homeland security. They can't get out of the box, especially when it comes to grant dollars. The only way some emergency managers will do anything is if grant dollars depend on it. And I'll go ahead and release that so you can actually see it. But let's take our point first, Bill, about small and medium-sized businesses in the community.
Well, I think that's a great point because, you look at any community and you probably have some kind of 80-20 rule that 80% of the income in that community is coming from 20% of the businesses. And so you've got a small group of businesses at the top that's easy to coordinate with, and then you've got a much larger number that maybe don't add up into so many dollars, but are hugely important in terms of determining the nature and the culture of the community, what makes it special, what may make it a community to begin with. So I think that's a terrific problem. We all struggle. I mean, you see our national government struggle with this. They've got several large industrial states, and then they have states with smaller populations and so on. And I think that that kind of provides the answer for the keys to something like this. So one thing, you know, you can imagine trying is to sort of have several groupings that try to capture say there might be one grouping that's sort of the larger corporations. There might be one grouping for the medium businesses. There might be one for small businesses or something. And then aggregation, sort of representatives from those who are talking about how it's working across those different sectors. Do you see what I mean? It's not much different from what we do with a family, particularly a large family. If you have a whole bunch of kids and they're a different range of ages, there are some things where you're sort of dealing with issues of family as a whole, and then there are other things where you specialize to what's important to the younger people or what's important to the older ones. That's not much of an answer, Susan, but you've identified a really difficult problem. But I think the key thing, and it's sort of like the family, you have to show some interest in dealing with this. I talked to a friend of mine who was in she's actually an in-law. She was in a very large family, and she said that when her dad died, one of her brothers said, at least he ignored us all equally. Well, that's a terrible kind of answer, but and it's something we have to fight all the time.
Let's bring Sam into this. Sam, did you have that medium to small business perspective represented in the workshops that you all did?
We did have some discussion during committee meetings, and I'm sure that Bill will correct me if I'm if I'm not representing it correctly. Some of our committee members were actually very much involved with helping communities develop these kinds of private-public collaborations. And I'm thinking of Lynn Bill, and what Lynn Kidder would probably have said would have been to try and identify those key people that are in touch with their own communities, whatever it might be, whether it be small businesses, whether it be non-native English speakers or whoever it might be, and to tap into the leaders of those particular networks and engaging through that, because obviously the table's not big enough for everybody to have a seat at it, but everybody can get engaged. How to do that specifically, I don't think that the report went into that kind of detail, and it's going to depend on the dynamics of the individual communities.
I think Sam made a great point there, and said it a lot better than I could. I should mention also that in our workshop that we had some very big companies like Home Depot and so on, and we had some very small companies as well. So the input that we were getting from the community consisted of this fuller spectrum.
If I could also just add another thing, the role of the press is one that I just came up with the workshop, is one that is often overlooked. I mean, sometimes, especially during emergency response activities, you know, you look at the press as sometimes a bit of a nuisance, getting in the way or passing on information that might not be the most helpful at that given moment. On the other hand, what some folks at the workshop were saying is that the press, members of the press are also members of the community, and they can be engaged beforehand as part of it, so as part of the collaboration. And, you know, that type of means of communicating can be quite powerful.
Exactly. We have a number of questions lined up for you. Let's move on a little bit. We have William Cummings with us today, and he asks, Dr. Hook, did you find any good models of resilience currently operating at state or local government level, local community, let's say?
First of all, hello, Bill. And secondly, well, we did find good models. I'm struggling a little bit to sort of pick one and zero in on one. Sam, maybe you have some thoughts. But
yep. The committee did highlight Safeguard Iowa as an example of a private-public collaboration. I think that committee members were like the idea of having that neutral body facilitating activities throughout the state. That would be a state level effort, and it was successful, from what I understand, to some extent in response to floods that occurred.
Yeah, right. And then on the local level, you also cite the Tulsa Partners. And
the work that she started there, definitely.
Yeah, and we have links to both of those efforts, again, on our background page. Okay.
You know, in addition to individual communities that have been special, and Tulsa is a terrific example because it's an example of where charismatic leadership really made a difference. But there are groups that sort of work on sort of a larger scale to try to pull to provide resources at the community level, and we looked at several of those, CARI, and one that we didn't discuss the way we should have in the report was part of the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Civic Leadership Council. And so there are a number of organizations that are trying to provide resources to communities as well.
This kind of comes back to Sam's point on the media, but we have a question from Chris Sager who says, well, maybe I missed this. And he asked, was there a mention of the role of social media in building collaborations?
Yes, and I'm going to turn that over to Sam because Sam also was involved in another academy study that zeroed in that particularly that was closely related to this one.
Absolutely. Just a quick brief background on that other study. That under the same contract from DHS that allowed us to produce this report that we're talking about today, we also had a workshop, and there was a summary along with that on the use of social network analysis for enhancing community disaster resilience. And it wasn't so much how do we use Twitter, how do we use Facebook, but it was about how do we analyze the data from such networks, and how do we look at social networks more broadly so that we can filter the information that's coming across those networks. We can decide what is good information, bad information, what is actionable, you know, what we need to do something about. This committee, certainly those networks came up, this study that we're talking about today, those social networks came up, and they were valued as tools for communication. The study didn't so much focus on how to use those. There was discussion, for example, on relying too much on electronic media, because if you have a full-scale disaster, you might lose power, which then limits your ability to completely depend on those. But they are important in terms of looking at existing, in terms of tapping into existing networks.
I think also, you know, every time you saw in the PowerPoint presentation that we were talking about build on existing networks, that included this kind of discussion. So you've got all sorts of dialogues going on in communities across the country about how to deal with healthcare in that community, or the protect the environment and the landscape around that community, or the grow the economy of that community. And again, the idea was to, as much get people talking as part of those discussions about disaster resilience as it was standing up new things to do that.
Yeah, social media, it was seen more as a tool rather than
right.
The means.
Let's move on to a question from John Cutler, who says, we've been pretty good at community collaboration on all disaster response levels. We have some industries who feel they might be exposing too much private information if they mm-hmm. share. Any suggestions on how to deal with this? And let's take that a little more broadly. And can you? Because I wanted to ask about, what kind of obstacles to this collaboration may have come up in the workshop in terms of, the private sector perspective.
Well, that's certainly a good point, and we see that all over. In my own arena, for example, the meteorological arena, the private sector is critical. Just to take one example, to putting satellites up into space to observe the atmosphere and oceans, and the companies who do that have common interests, and yet they also compete with each other. And so it's a constant balancing act to protect that privacy, to agree on things that represent a certain common good, and to focus on that. And it's the kind of sensitivity that we all are required in any kind of discussion we have with people about respecting their privacy while sort of building trust and looking at common objectives.
Okay. A question from Marilyn Hilliard, or it's kind of a comment in the question form. She says, regarding, quote, focus on the community, unquote, statements, should we instead think of in terms of community-based or community-initiated? We ask because focus on the community seems to imply that someone other than the community is in charge.
Bill, would you like me to take a quick stab at that?
Take a stab at it.
I think the language in the report, Marilyn, would completely support your point of view. I think that community-focused collaboration needs to be initiated at the community level. I think that's what the committee would say. And that is really the only way that you can get buy-in from the community if it rises from the community.
I think this has been sort of implicit in Hazard's work for a long time. If you look at a flooding event or something that affects a particular county, the president can feel that county's pain, but the president has 3,000 other counties where that one came from, and things are happening in those on an ongoing basis too. So any local government and local business, locally based business, have an entirely different sort of risk-reward structure from the sort of national risk-reward structure in looking at this. But I thought your comment, Marilyn, was terrific.
Okay, let's go on. I have a question from Emily Myers, And a nice segue here from the previous one. She says, what are some examples of ways to reward boundary-spanning individuals and organizations? I mean, does the report suggest incentives in that direction?
I think one, and it goes back to the media example, one very inexpensive way to do this is to recognize it within the community. So if the community is making its safety relative to the river that runs through it or the tornadoes it sees periodically or something, if they're making that a priority and they're shining a very favorable spotlight on the people who are doing this and sort of saying, hey, Jane or Fred or whoever has really worked a lot of hours off the clock doing this, and we all owe them a debt of gratitude. That helps as much as anything else. I think another thing that really helps is, sort of listening to the folks and the individuals and the corporations who are doing this. A lot of the motivation for this is in seeing things actually improve, not just the recognition. So, but if you sort of picture yourself, you know, butting your head against the brick wall or whatever, sometimes you tend to give up. Being responsive a little bit to what the suggestions are is magical in terms of providing some incentive.
Pam, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, this is something that Kathleen Tierney on the committee would have had a lot to say about it. It is an interesting question, and it is actually one of the challenges to collaboration that is highlighted in the report. And I think that that's an area that probably needs some more research on exactly how to do that. More effort is definitely needed to promoting and facilitating multi-sector collaboration. And there's more training that's needed, and currently it's not really there within organizational culture.
You know, you mentioned Kathleen Tierney. Another committee member, Brent Woodworth, is listed as being with the Los Angeles Emergency Preparedness Foundation, but he really worked for a decade or so for IBM. And they had a rapid response team that would go into earthquake areas or flooded areas worldwide, and they would reestablish a sort of information technology infrastructure again for that country. They just sort of, or that location, that sort of swoop in and put it there. And it was a great way to sort of brand what they could do. So I think another thing, not all companies or NGOs are going to be will have equal incentives here. Some will have special incentives like that, and you can look to them.
Right. I have a question from Alex Rose, which I can answer. He asks, can you share a link to a report or summary of that social network workshop that was just described? And again, that, Alex, that is another link that is on our background page. So if you go there, it'll take you right to it. All right. Let's see. I've got a question from Ava Dean. She says, Bill, I love the idea of public-private collaboration or partnership. However, we won't have resilient communities and a resilient nation until we educate citizens, individuals, and families that they must be resilient as well. In your esteemed opinion, how do we make believers of all the players, not just the big companies and businesses in the private sector?
I get nervous when anybody says esteemed in the same phrase as my opinion. But, again, people, we all, somehow we made this transition with putting on seatbelts, didn't we? We kind of went from You know, a few people doing it to everybody doing it and regulations to do it. We've done the same thing with smoking, you know, in terms of now it happens out on the streets as opposed to, and this, you know, we should see as likely to go the same direction and over the same kind of time scale. But I think going back to some of the points we were making about entraining the education community, thinking about K through 12 education, and doing this, thinking of it in sort of generational terms, that this looks far more possible. It is possible to have these cultural shifts. You've got to have one that really matters. I think as we sort of watch how the Japanese have responded to their earthquake and tsunami, we've seen much to admire and a few lessons to learn. And as particularly as applies to our Pacific Northwest, all those states along the Cascadia subduction zone up there, I think that provides a kind of teachable moment. We have that kind of culture in the aviation community. In the aviation community, there's a real culture of learning from experience. When the airplane accident occurs, people swarm all over the accident site and say, we don't want this to ever happen again. And that's quite different from a culture that says we're going to rebuild just like before. And we can move from one to the other.
Inez Pierce, a committee member, once described the need to engender the expectation that such an organization in a community will exist, this organization, this collaborative organization, and she likened it to a chamber of commerce. You can't go to almost any size community in the country without finding a local chapter of a chamber of commerce, and it's that group that's expected to basically be the what's the word that I'm looking for, the support for the business community on issues that are important to them. Well, the expectation needs to be engendered within the community that this collaboration exists to support the needs of building disaster resilience.
Got a couple more left that we can we'll have time to get to today. I've got one from Dan Irati. He says, is it, quote, too honest to suggest that collaborative relationships may be built on based on needs? For example, emergency management performing a gap analysis may find solutions within their own community through local businesses with whom they can develop a relationship to deploy resources during an incident response. From a private sector perspective, emergency management can provide to business areas of expertise that they may lack, disaster planning, training and exercise, and for their continuity of operations and for the safety of their employees and families. Put that in there. Okay.
If I understand that right, I think that's a great comment that the whole essence of collaboration, it's not just that you're doing it for its own sake, you're doing it because you can achieve some larger purpose only in that way.
And it actually, you know, one of the first steps in the practical guidance that the committee offers is that you need to identify what the need is of the community and then to figure out, you know, who are the primary stakeholders in the need to address those needs, with respect to those needs, who has the resources and the capacity in order to address those needs. And in that way, you can tap, and if I understand the question correctly, Dan, I think what you can, it's fair to say is that it is quite reasonable to say, hey, we need to be able to get trucks from A to B, and we know these roads will likely be closed under these circumstances. You know, what kind of resources can you provide, or, you know, can we use your parking lot, or whatever it might be? I think it's an incredibly, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily to be that direct as I think you're implying, Dan.
Well, I think what his point is that, you know, maybe some of the incentive for collaboration is the notion that you can do something for me and I can do something for you.
Oh, the committee absolutely agreed, I think, and I think they state it fairly clearly in the report that collaboration is good for the bottom line and that there is value for the participants in collaboration to collaborate long before you have a disaster, there is much more immediate benefit. And so be honest about it. Celebrate the benefits. And I think that's one thing that was stressed in the development of the model in the report is that you do something right, you celebrate it because that gets more people involved.
Now, one more we'd like to that we have time for. It's kind of a general question the way Susan Sanderson has framed it. She asks, is anything being done with the emergency management organizations? Specifically, she mentions IAM and NEMA. I know both of those, believe both of those organizations do have at least private sector committees. But I'd like to take this a little broader and in terms of outreach and what's next with the study results. I presume you turn around and submitted it back to Department of Homeland Security. What do you see for the future in terms of following it up or some results coming from it?
Do you mean from the report itself?
Yeah, from the report itself.
Well, I know that DHS had been very serious about getting the research recommendations that this committee and the committee that put together the workshop on social network analysis, they wanted those research recommendations so that they can determine how best to spend their research dollars in this area. So just from the, if I understand the question correctly, that was one of the reasons for doing this. So presumably they would now go back and follow up on some of that research. They've also asked for some derivative products based on this. They didn't call them derivative products, but there's a pamphlet, which I think you have a link for on your cover page, Amy.
Yes, it's in the handouts also. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, for example, DHS asked us to produce that specifically geared toward toward community leadership. How do we get those folks? What information do they need to know? They don't really care what kind of research is needed. They want to know what they can do on the ground. So there's already been some, I mean, this briefing, for example, is some of the outcomes from having produced this report. We're trying to get the word out as much as possible and disseminate it as much as possible.
I think Sam made some excellent points. She and I were over last month briefing an interagency group of maybe a dozen or so federal agencies on this work. The committee members are plugged into the community in a diverse set of ways, and they've all been working on this topic before the committee assignment came up. They weren't obviously going to stop. Now they have a tool that they can use. And so we are taking every invitation that we can get and trying to respond favorably to it. And we're also injecting it into all of our conversations in a variety of different directions as we move around. As I said at the beginning, this is a topic that goes beyond sort of a single academy report. There are a lot of people, practitioners and researchers and policymakers and journalists, everybody in between, who are fretting about this, and good things are going to happen, I believe.
That's great. And that's a great note to wrap up on for today. Thank you very much, Bill and Sam. We do appreciate you taking time to be with us and share these ideas. And as you mentioned, for any folks in our audience that might be going to the World Conference on Disaster Management in Toronto this summer, Bill will be there doing this presentation.
with Michael Dunaway. So come and hear what he's got to say on this. He's very thoughtful on this subject.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Again, everyone, the recording should be available later this afternoon. And if you're not on a mailing list and would like to get notices of future sessions and availability of the transcripts and so on, just go to our homepage to subscribe. Now, before you go, please do take a moment to do this rating or comment. And note, we just ask you to rate the relevance of the information, and this assists us with our programming decisions. Now, let me make just a couple of announcements. We are pleased to welcome two new EIIP partners today. We have FEMA Region 7, located in Kansas City, represented by private sector liaison Scott Weinberg, and Snohomish County, Washington Medical Reserve Corps, represented by Therese Quinn, who is here with us today. Welcome to both of them. Please do look them up on our partners page. And if your organization is interested in partnership, just please see the link from our homepage or on your announcements. Now, please note, our next program, we have a little scheduling change. It will take place noon Eastern on a Thursday, May 5th, in order to bring you a special program with Timothy Manning, FEMA Deputy Administrator for National Protection and Preparedness. Mr. Manning will share his perspectives from the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand. And please make plans to join us at that time. Until then, thanks to everyone for participating today. Thank you very much for the good questions and good comments. And we hope you have a great afternoon. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.